Hi, my name is Andy, and I'm an intern here at the Guild, and really happy to be a part of this new podcast series that we're doing. It's going to be headed up by Scott Dillman, but in this first one, I got to interview Scott and Sarah Jane, who are both on staff here at the Guild. And for the last 4 years, they've been going down to Haiti for 2 or 3 weeks at a time and training people on how to do ceramics, which is a bit of specialty for both of them. And this project has really just taken off from being pretty much one person, one contact that they had down there, to now being employing over 300 artisans. And it's had quite an impact, and it's impacted Scott and Sarah Jane as well. So we had a little discussion about it. Dan Orberg, the director, was there as well. And so we invite you to listen in if you have any questions or feedback. Please contact us, or you can check out the Apparent Project at www.apparentproject.org. So yeah, if, maybe off the bat, if you could maybe tell us a bit about the Apparent Project and how you guys got involved.
Mm-hmm. I got involved with the Apparent Project in 2011 when Corrigan Clay came to the Guild to try to find a potter to help start clay production down there. And I said yes, without really knowing what that would mean. They got a grant from, what's a grant from Donna Karen?
No, Maria Bello?
Maria Bello, that's right, the actress Maria Bello. The grant was enough to bring two potters down to see if it was even feasible to do clay production in Haiti. And so Sarah Jane was on faculty at the time, and we were building some kilns together. And I just thought, well, if we're building kilns now, we might as well, you know, build kilns down in Haiti. So I went down there.
Were you already at the Guild at that time?
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd been on staff here for, at that point, like 4 years, three years, something like that. Mm-hmm. My first year was 2007.
Okay.
At the Guild.
Mm-hmm. And I, at that time, was only on summer faculty. I didn't move to the Guild until the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan, how did you, when this opportunity came up, did you kind of see this as a natural extension of the Guild, or did you say, well, you're going on vacation, have a good time, see ya?
No, it really was a natural extension, because the Guild is really about art in the context of people's lives, and I thought it was an amazing opportunity for Guild artisans to be involved with something that was bigger than us, particularly when it comes to people actually making a living at doing artwork was fantastic, and I would love to see Guild do more of those kind of things. So it was really natural in my mind, and the opportunity for Scott to go and his willingness to go was just kind of like, oh, perfect, let's just try this, see how it goes. And then Sarah Jane jumped on too, it just became this bigger thing, and it's really grown from that point. So that was
4 years ago?
Yeah.
Okay.
4 years ago.
And then what was, so you roped her in?
Pretty much,
basically.
Yeah.
And how did he get you to do that? What did he promise you, or
we were in this like really geeky kiln building phase. I think we built 5 kilns in 2 weeks or something like that.
Yeah.
And so it was like, hey, it doesn't have to end here. We can go to Haiti.
Yeah.
I couldn't say yes right away. I had to get permission. I was teaching at Asbury University at the time, and the time frame for the trip, I actually had to take some time off work. And so I was really blessed because they also saw it as a part of their mission, and I was able to get some time off work to be able to go. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
And had either of you done international travel much before, or was this kind of a new...
I'd been to Europe, actually with the Guild, on 2 Guild trips previous to that. But I had never been to the developing world before. So.
Mm-hmm. And I'm the same way. I had done a couple of Europe trips, but I had no idea what I was getting into.
Yeah. Did you have major reservations at first, or were you kind of just seeing it as an adventure and seeing it as a, you know?
I said yes, I would do this project before I had really even thought about, before I knew anything about Haiti. I knew that there was an earthquake that happened the year before, and I knew the country was pretty devastated, but other than that, I didn't know anything about it. And when I initially said yes, I just did it. I thought, this is what I should be doing. And so I said yes. And then it was only later that I thought, oh, I don't know what I've gotten myself into here. And it turned out fantastic.
We've had several conversations with other people on similar kind of mission projects through Nicaragua and Mexico was another one that we talked about doing some kind of an art exchange, culture exchange. Never seemed to kind of come together. So this one came out of the blue. I didn't design this one. That was Corgan just called us one day and said he wanted to talk to us about what he was doing in Haiti, and it kind of came sideways. But it was exactly the kind of thing that I wanted to see us be involved with, as far as getting involved with developing countries, having cultural exchange, seeing art as a huge fabric of people's healing and recovery of life, and this kind of fit really nicely. So,
did you have any reservations of thinking like, what am I actually going to do when I get there? Like, am I going to be well received, or am I, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then, what was that initial experience like for you as you got there on the ground, and you know, were you kind of figuring it out as you went, or did you have a kind of initial game plan?
Well, I figured we were going to be pretty well received down there, because at that point the Apparent Project had been in existence for 2 years, and they had already had other teams that have come down and helped start other projects. I had absolutely no idea what it was actually going to be like when I got there, and when we had done some planning over the phone and by emails, trying to figure out, okay, you know, I'm going to take care of, like, you know, figuring out how to roll the beads, make some bead bars. We were going to be doing some research. Sarah Jane had access to a library at the university that she was working at, so was able to pull some texts and things that I didn't have available. And so we had some rough planning before we went. But it was really a proof of concept trip. You know, they weren't sure this was possible. We weren't sure it was possible. We only had 13 days to do this, to build a kiln, to fire a kiln, to get some bead production started.
To find materials
to find
build
materials.
A kiln? To learn how to process local clay?
Yeah. Because the whole goal of us coming down is to see how much we could do without importing, like how much we could do with resources that were already there. And Corrigan and Shelley had no idea what was there. They weren't potters. They had never worked in clay before, and we had never been there, so we didn't know what was available. And so the initial part of that first trip was just going everywhere in Port-au-Prince, running around, you know, to different markets and street vendors, and trying to see, you know, do you have bricks? Do you have clay? Like, do you have wire to string the beads? And it was pretty shocking for me when we went down there the first time, because at the time the airport was still collapsed from the earthquake. And so we got off the plane. We met in Miami, I think.
We were on the same flight from Miami
to Port-au-Prince, and we get off the plane, and it's just it's basically an old hangar. An airplane hangar where the immigrations and everything was, and there was no lines anywhere. It was just, you know, tons of people milling around and no air conditioning. It was crazy hot, and we didn't speak any Creole. And it was kind of madness. And then we got out of the airport, somehow, because there's a whole bunch of people that are trying to take your bags and help you out and then do things. And we got out of the airport, right in front of a tent city.
Yeah. I think for me, I had seen news footage after the earthquake. And so I had this impression of all of Haiti as this kind of, you know, colorless, devastated, awful place. And I think that I was so taken that first trip with how colorful it was, that there was music playing, that it was like, oh, well, this is a place where people live, and it has a lot of poverty, but it also has a lot of beauty. And I was really, what I had worked it up to in my head was not as scary and not as, I mean, in my head it was worse than what the reality was.
And I think I really tried to avoid looking at a lot of, which in retrospect was a terrible idea, but I really tried to avoid doing a lot of research into what Haiti was, what life was like down there, because I was pretty scared going down, but I didn't want to be biased either. Like, this was a whole new project, a whole new thing that was starting, and I just wanted to go down there with fresh eyes and just see, okay, what can we do?
And in that initial trip, you guys basically you were able to build a kiln and do some initial training. I'm trying to remember, because from your presentation earlier today, there was one main contact there that you had that you were kind of working with, and then kind of recruiting more people. Is that about right? And doing some training with that. And what did you see kind of in that first trip, as far as what you know, what you guys were able to accomplish and what kind of came out of it.
Yeah, the first trip, so Corrigan had found a guy who had just moved in from the country, who had came from a big family, and they weren't able to support themselves, and so he was the oldest brother, and he came into Port-au-Prince looking for a job, and somehow met with Corrigan or Shelley, yeah. I'm not sure which one, and his name is Fresnel, and they thought, well, he's pretty smart, he seems like he has a lot of initiative, maybe he would be a good person to lead out on this. And so when we got down there, we met him, and basically we worked with him through every step of the process. We worked with him to build the kiln, we tried as much as we could to show him how to build the kiln, how to fire the kiln. And then we taught a couple people how to roll beads, how to make ceramic beads. But it was mainly Fresnel we worked with, mostly. And that whole first trip was really just getting the ball rolling for the ceramic program. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't know if it was possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have much to add.
All right.
Okay. Dan, anything to add there?
No.
And then what happened after that? So you're able to accomplish a bit with that first kind of whirlwind trip, but then you're also training people. And then you kind of left them with some skills, left them with the kiln. And then what did you see kind of happen over those next few years, I guess?
Well, it was really fun after we left to watch on Facebook and by email and see how things were growing, and that they were producing ceramic beads, and those were starting to show up in some of the jewelry. And so, you know, you got a sense of the program building. But I think it was really surprising to come back. And it was maybe 15 months later.
Mm-hmm.
So just a little over a year that we came back. And there were 10 guys that were working full time making beads and supporting their families. And there were, you know, there's a whole separate line of jewelry that was based out of these ceramic beads. And They had bought an electric kiln at that point, and they mm-hmm. had, you know, established the space for those guys to work. And so just seeing how much it grew. And then we came in on that second trip, and at that point they were saying, well, we're kind of doing great on the beads. We don't really need a lot of help with that, but you want to train some people how to make pottery. Mm-hmm. And so that was how we got into the pottery side of things.
Yeah. Yeah.
I
think what we do on each of our trips is we give a little bit of momentum. We push people a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's their willingness to work and to explore new things. And because this is how they're making their living and supporting their families, they have a lot of perseverance and desire. And so we give them a little bit of direction. But then the real work happens while we're gone. And they're figuring out on their own, figuring out the best ways of production down there. You know, we don't obviously live in Haiti, and so we might have a good idea of thinking, oh, this would work best in our studio, but that maybe doesn't work the best down there. And luckily there are enough intelligent people and interested people that can figure those things out for themselves down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's part of it is the difference in location. And then the other part is that neither you nor I make our living selling pottery. Like we are not production potters in our daily lives. And there are just some things about production work that are different.
Mm-hmm.
And apart from this, you know, most of the potters we've trained people who've gone on to become vocational potters, but they start out in art classes.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a really different way of thinking.
And so over the last 4 or 5 years, you've seen it grow from originally it was like one guy, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
One guy who just had you know, some ambition and so you guys went and tried to help, and the parent project is kind of continuing, you know, supporting that group of people. But now it's basically up to, you said, about 300 working people. And
For the whole parent project is 300 people. There are about 50 people that work full time in ceramic production.
That's just amazing.
Yeah, it is.
You know, and the types of, could you talk maybe a little bit about the types of jewelry, types of work that they're producing? I love the idea of them taking some of these everyday discarded materials like cereal boxes and cracker boxes and oil drums and things like that, and upcycling them into jewelry, into, you know, beautiful pieces of art. Could you talk maybe a bit about that and what that kind of art looks like and how that process kind of came about?
Yeah. Well, one of the problems in Port-au-Prince is it's this city of more than 2 million people, and there's not any kind of centralized trash removal service, and so there's garbage everywhere. And so one of the goals of this project was, how do we take this material that is free, that is abundant, that's actually causing a problem, and how do we turn that into jobs for people? And so the very first thing that they started doing was taking old cereal boxes and that kind of lightweight cardboard and rolling them into paper beads. And that began in 2009. And at this point, they are doing that. They're recycling aluminum pop cans. They are using steel oil drums and pounding metal art out of those. They're doing recycled paper to make journals. They're taking scrap fabric and sewing with that, sewing all kinds of things. Help me out, Scott.
Yeah, well, there was a history in Haiti of using kind of discarded materials for art. Croix des Bouquets is a little neighborhood just outside of Port-au-Prince that is pretty well known for quite a while, for 40, 50 years, for doing the metal drum work, where they would take old oil drums, flatten them out, cut them with chisels, and do some wall hangings. And when a lot of people think of Haitian art, they think of the metal work, or they think of paper mache masks. Mm-hmm. It's because Haiti is on an island, it's always hard to get materials in. And because there's not a lot of money and there's a lot of issues with import of raw materials, just what is available is what's laying around. I think Shelley was saying that there was just piles of cereal boxes outside of the house they were living in, and they thought, well, let's just use these. Mm-hmm. And now, like, they're importing cereal boxes into the island. Like, there are no more cereal boxes to be found on the streets of Port-au-Prince, which is amazing.
Yeah, that's incredible. I love that idea that it's taking things that are discarded, just people, aren't using or they see no use for, and creating something beautiful out of that, creating something functional. Yeah. I think that's such a cool way to do art.
Yeah.
Well, we just take it for granted in our culture that we have everything available to us all the time, and pretty cheaply, actually.
Yeah.
But when you get to another culture that doesn't have that, you have to be creative. You have to think out of the box and come up with some different ways of doing things. So.
Yeah. Well, and that's really a Haitian lifestyle is figuring out, how do I make something work with the materials that I have on hand? Because there's never been a lot of money in that country, and there's never been a lot of resources available. And so you just figure out, how am I going to make this work? And I think that attitude really, really plays well into art making, because so much of art making is just, how do I make this work? And what do I have around to do this with? And they've taken that and run with it. And the jewelry that they're making, it's interesting. It's not... there's some of it that's just the paper beads strung on jewelry wire and sold. But they're really interested in designing interesting modern jewelry and interesting modern ceramics that are not just going to be for the tourist market of, oh, I went to Haiti and I picked up this nice little thing to bring back to my friends. But this is relevant anywhere. Like, this is hip, current stuff that we're producing. One of the things that is talked about a lot down there is charity buying. You're going to buy something when you go down to visit because, oh, well, this is so nice. These Haitians made this, and I'm going to bring that back for a little souvenir. And that's great. It's good to get money flowing that way, but that's not sustainable. Mm-hmm. That's not going to bring repeat business, which is so important for any artist, is repeat customers. And so to have things that aren't just, well, that was nice because Haitians made it, but to have something that goes, this is really nice. Like, I don't know where else I could find this. I really like this. Mm-hmm. That's really important. I think that's what they've done so successfully down there, is the stuff that is coming out is interesting and unique, and it is valuable not just because it's made in Haiti, but because it's a well-made product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just seeing some of the jewelry today, I didn't think of it as being like, oh, that's nice, like, that's cute, so mm-hmm. I like buy it because of sympathy or whatever. It's actually really well-made jewelry. Like, and it's interesting. Because it's, at least the pieces that I saw, that it was made out of some of those recycled materials, I think it's fascinating, but then just aesthetically, it looks good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think there's an issue of dignity, too. that we think about, oh, this is a good project because it helps people support their families, it helps them send their kids to school, it helps break the cycle of poverty. But I also think if people are buying your jewelry because they feel sorry for you, mm-hmm. that does not build your dignity as a human being.
Yeah.
If people are buying your jewelry because you make awesome jewelry or awesome pottery or awesome, you know, wall art or whatever, there is a sense of worth as a human being that comes out of that. Mm-hmm. That's really hard to quantify, but we see it in the people that we work with. And it's one of the things that I've found most moving about this project is being able to give people back something.
Mm-hmm.
And just their sense of worth as people.
Well, and I'm sure it's really gratifying for you guys too, I'm sure, to go and feel like you're giving, you know, something that you have, a skill that you have, and here is something which was just a really, you know, kind of a seed of an idea, which you had no idea where it could go, and here you go, and kind of give what you have, and you know, this group of people has kind of taken it and latched onto it and run with it. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's not just that you have a few people who are making art, but it's impacting their local economics. And like you said, their self-worth and, you know, all these just huge, huge ideas, which is so cool when you think about, you know, where it started from.
And,
Well, now as an administrator, I think not being going down there myself, I see what it gives the two of them to go down there. So it's one thing to think about how we're benefiting people in Haiti, but I think people in Haiti are benefiting us. Mm-hmm. And just the opportunity for this to enrich their lives and their art making and watch their excitement, their passion grow, their relationships grow with the people down there, for them to say they want to be down there not just to be useful, but also because they have friends down there.
There's
a whole lot of rest of it. You know, it's more than just project and doing something nice for people. It's about building relationships, and it's about enhancing each other's lives. And that goes both ways. It's not one way at all.
I think it's like any really good teaching situation. I think that both the students and the instructor both benefit. And if it's only going one way, you know, it doesn't fit very well. It's maybe something isn't really meshing or connecting. And that's what I really feel down there. Is I'm going down and using a skill that I know and helping people, but that is giving me so much back to me in my life. And I think everybody that works down there, you know, there's that sharing. I think that one of the things, because both Sarah Jane and I were involved in the guild before we went down to Haiti, and one of the things that the guild does so well is when we teach classes, there's not a sense of the instructor is above the student. There's not a sense of, you know, the instructor, you know, towering over the class and saying, this is the one way to do it, this is the right way to do it, and there's no other way. It's really a partnership. You're working together in the studio to create some good art and to help people along the way. And that's really what I feel is happening down there, is we are going down there and we're working with people in partnership and growing everybody and going forward.
All right. So you guys, it's obviously not just you two that are going down there and now have done this amazing thing. Who else has kind of been involved in this on the state side? And, you know, is there anybody else that you want to give a shout out to?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so after our first trip, we were contacted by two women from Colorado, Nicole Coppell and Donna Rasman. And they had read a little bit on the blog about what we were doing, and they were interested in getting involved. And so beginning in 2013, they've met up with us in Haiti each year, and they've been a part of our teaching team as well. And it's just been great to split the teaching between four people, especially when it comes to stuff like troubleshooting. It's so helpful to have a couple of extra heads and a couple of, you know, just more experience between us. And, you know, we'll look at a student who's really struggling with something, and it's like, man, you know, well, we've tried this one in one of my classes, and, oh, I've seen this work for somebody. It's just made it a really rich experience.
Well, it's a nice mix of working styles between the four of us. You know, we all kind of specialize in a different little nook in pottery. And so whereas, you know, just one or two of us, there might be some holes in our knowledge. There definitely is some holes in our knowledge and gaps between the four of us together. We're a pretty well-rounded teaching machine. And that's really nice. You know, I don't have much I don't do a whole lot of fine surface decoration in my pottery. I don't do a lot of detail work, but yet you know Donna does. That's what all she does is very fine painting on pottery. That's not all she does, but that's a good part of what she does.
Yeah,
and that's really helpful. And I think we all bring a little bit to that.
Well, and it's been fun. We actually have never even seen them in the States.
Yeah,
we only meet up in Haiti, but it's been so fun. The working relationship that we've developed over the last 3 years, and it just feels like we're really comfortable, and things like knowing each other's strengths, and so, you know, knowing that, like, oh, if we have a geeky chemistry question, we'll hand that one over to Scotty or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know, it's been a really good experience. And
Well, and then also Shelley Clay, who is kind of the CEO of Papillon, which is the for-profit business side in Port-au-Prince. While she doesn't have a lot of, she doesn't have knowledge in pottery, she is a big mover and motivator down there. And, you know, everybody that works with the Apparent Project and with Papillon on the business and administrative side really helps push along this program and helps fund it and get new equipment and fundraise. And that's really important. You know, if it was just us potters, we probably wouldn't be doing much but getting dirty in clay down there. And they're the ones that have made this a viable business. And I think that's really, really important.
Yeah. God bless all the admin people.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Amen. Yeah, that's right.
Well, and I would also give a shout out to the Clinton Foundation, because they've been really faithful in helping to upgrade equipment when we've needed it, helping that studio to grow so that basically as soon as the market is available for more people to be working, more product to be pushed out, they've made sure that the infrastructure is there so that it can grow as fast as possible, and that those jobs can be created as soon as the need is there.
Mm-hmm. And so you guys have gone back each year, basically, for the last 4 years, and kind of for a range of, you know, 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks at a time.
Yeah.
So where are things at now, and where do you kind of see them going?
Yeah. Well, right now, there are 300 total artisans working with the Apparent Project. 50 of those are working directly in clay in some capacity. There are people who are processing the clay, bead rollers, the potters, and people who glaze all of the work. Right now, we have 5 potters that have 3 years of training, and 4 new potters that have just had the 1 session of training from our last trip. And it's growing very, very fast. The experienced potters are able to help train the new potters, so their level of expertise is bringing into that, and they are the new potters are learning much faster. And I only see the limit to how far the clay program will grow is what space they have to work in. They are pretty much maxed out in their studio space. And every square inch of the artisan house that isn't being used for something else has some sort of clay production happening in it. but I think that if that ever gets resolved, and if there is ever more space, it's going to just continue growing.
Yeah. Well, and there, while we were there this past time, we looked at some potential rental spaces in the neighborhood that they might expand into, and they're starting to look at architectural plans to build a big production facility. Yeah. So I think that will get resolved.
Yeah.
But it's interesting when the business grows so quickly, to see that there's just growing pains every step of the way. Because whatever facility they have, whatever infrastructure they have, they're always maxing it out.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing about teaching pottery and training these potters is this is not just a skill that they can use while they're working for the Apparent Project. This is a vocational skill that they can have for the rest of their lives. And so if for whatever reason the potters are not always working with Papillon and with the Apparent Project, they can take these skills and start their own business, and they can start their own pottery. And it's really a lifelong skill. And in, you know, traditionally in the past, you know, it was a family operation. And so, you know, the parents would teach their kids pottery, and then they would take over the studio and all the way down. And I don't know if that's going to happen down there, but it certainly has the potential because there aren't a lot of potters working down there, and there's definitely a market for it. And it is a long-term skill to have.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One thing that you guys alluded to that Dan mentioned that I thought was really insightful and helpful as far as, you know, I think it has implications for people that are doing short-term mission trips, but also just generally in how we do art in terms of thinking about the relationship of, are we doing it for the other or for ourselves, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious for you guys of how these experiences have then impacted the art that you've done back here.
Yeah.
Or maybe just, maybe it isn't even physically the art, but, you know, maybe how you're thinking about it or, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, for me, after the second trip, I had a real kind of crisis in my own art where I had gone down and trained the first round of potters and realized, like, this is life-changing stuff that we were doing. Like, this is affecting their lives. This is a skill they'll have forever. And I came back and I kind of thought, oh, now what am I doing? Like, am I just poking around? Am I playing? You know, and it took me a while to get through that. But I think how it's affected me the most is I've taken my art much more seriously now. I realize that I'm not just playing. This is what I'm doing. This is what I'm meant to do. Knowing that there are people out there that have been trained and that their lives depend on this has given me much more focus and much more seriousness in my own work.
Wow.
Yeah.
I guess I don't think so much about how it's changed my art specifically. I feel like it's given me a different perspective on every part of my life, on my teaching for sure, my relationships with other people, being grateful for what I have, recognizing that the things I don't have probably aren't as important as I think they are. and there are lots of situations, and I know Scotty and I both do this, you know, we'll be driving down the road and we'll see something on the side of the road and what would our Haitian friends say about that? and just being able to see the world through somebody else's eyes, I think has been probably for me the richest part of it, and was fairly unexpected. I didn't know going into it that that's what I was going to come away with, and it's just been wonderful.
You know, and I haven't even been to Haiti yet, and yet Haiti's closer than it used to be.
Yeah,
because there's people. My friends have friends in Haiti now. And makes me desire to go there, not just because the country looks beautiful, but because now I feel there's a connection there that wasn't there before. And that's secondhand, but it's still significant.
Yeah. Well, it feels like we live in such a disconnected age.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a variety of reasons, but it just made me think of the one of the bracelets that you guys have that you were selling earlier today that has a tag going around it that has the person's picture on it who made it and a little bit about their story.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there's something that instantly sort of elevates then that piece.
Yeah.
You know, when you think of the thought and care that went into it, and especially in the States, like, we get so many things that are just kind of manufactured, mm-hmm. and made in a factory someplace, and you don't really think about that somebody was really involved with, you know, physically producing this piece, and it's really moving to know too that it's I'm not just getting something selfishly that you know, because it looks good for me or for my wife or whatever, but that it's I'm supporting somebody else, like,
yeah.
I'm it's my vote of confidence in their art and what they're doing. And, yeah, it's was my bit about my experience buying a bracelet earlier today.
Well, yeah, just your first step. You're going to get sucked in now.
No,
look out.
All right. What was the best thing you ate?
Oh. There was a little restaurant around the corner from the guest house that we stayed in, which a restaurant, it was a tarp and a couple picnic tables on the side of the street. And the woman who ran it, was named was Madame Jadel, and she was a riot. She would say hi to us every morning, and she was very loud. She talked very loud, a very fast Creole. And I don't speak very fast Creole, but I did my best. but she had great lunches every day. Starting about 1 o'clock, she would serve rice and beans and chicken. But in the mornings, she had these things called pâtés, which were dough kind of like a hot pocket that had lots of good meat and vegetables in it, and then deep fried. And you could pick one of those up for like 25 cents, and they were so good.
Deep fried for 25 cents.
It was so nice. So that was definitely the best thing I ate.
I would have to. I definitely enjoyed Madame Jodelle's cooking, but this past time I was very taken with the mangoes and the avocados that we were getting from the local market. I'm pretty much spoiled. I can't deal with the ones that we import to the U.S. anymore.
I wanted to ask a couple more questions here. One was just maybe if you could tell your favorite story of a person who's been affected by, you know, the work that you guys have done down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so Fresnel was the guy that we worked with at the very beginning, from the very beginning of the project, and when we first met him, he was pretty meek. He wouldn't look you in the eye. He was, you know, pretty just overwhelmed by everything that was happening. We worked with him the whole step of the way. And then the next year that we came down, and he ended up being in charge of the whole studio. He's the shop manager. We came down, and as soon as I walked in, he gave me a big hug and looked me in the eye and went and showed me around everything and was so proud of what had happened. And that continues every time we go down there. This last trip, I got to build some tables, and he helped me. We had some man time building tables with power tools and things like that. My Creole is not good enough to have really good conversations, and his English isn't all that great. But just that connection of, like, we are just two people working on this project, making it happen. And that was just... it doesn't get any better for me than that.
Yeah. And similar story with Stephanie, who was one of the original potters that we trained. And all of those women, when we first met them, had that same kind of just meekness. And so we've been able to watch her grow in skill. And then in the last year, she's been made manager of the pottery studio. And she's 23 years old and has a 10th grade education, although she's hoping to go back to school. She's got a little boy that she's raising, and I think the really fun thing, she's been taking English classes, which is something that all the managers are doing, and my Creole is slowly getting better, and so just being able to talk more, and she was telling me, like, as soon as she moves out of her parents' house, she's going to get tattoos, and what kind of tattoos she wants to get, and it was just really fun to be able to have just a casual conversation, and, you know, I was... showing her how to do something one day with some construction adhesive, and she looks up at me and she said, "We should glue Fresnel's mouth shut." It's that kind of thing that a friendship is built out of. So it's just been really great.
Yeah. Last question: how can people get involved if they're kind of been moved by what you're talking about and want to get involved with the Apparent Project or want to do something similar? What would you recommend for a next step?
Well, the Apparent Project's website is apparentproject.org. And, you know, if you want to do something really entry level, you can host a jewelry party. And that's a way to get some of these products sent to your house. You can show a little video, share it with some of your friends. Sell some things, send some money back to Haiti. That's probably the simplest way to get involved. They also do fundraiser bracelets, so regardless of what you're raising money for, that's a way to help get the word out and also raise some money. They're also always looking for people to come down and teach. And so if you have a skill that you're interested in sharing that might be useful for somebody in a job creation kind of setting,
can always
start with the website and get a hold of somebody and see, is that a skill that would be useful and what would that look like?
Yeah, and both Apparent Project and Papillon Industries have a great presence on Facebook and social media, and so you can look up both the Apparent Project and Papillon Industries on Facebook, and
Papillon Enterprise.
Papillon Enterprises. They post pictures every day of what's happening down there, new products coming out, and it's a great way to follow.
Great. Well, any final words, Dan? You want to weigh in on anything there?
Yeah, just giving artists that work here the opportunity to do this kind of work is pretty important to me. And I know as we get busier, as the guild continues to grow, it's harder and harder to let these guys go for 3 weeks at a time. But at the same time, it's a priority that we all have because we all want to participate in that project as well. And how we participate is by covering them when they're gone. Mm-hmm. And that's our contribution. And certainly, if people are interested in getting to know more about this or want to support them going down to Haiti, that'll help us a lot too. It costs money to send them down there, and so they can't afford to fly down there themselves. So that's another way to get involved as far as supporting us to do it. But I would like to see more and more of this kind of cultural exchange is happening.
Yeah.
And seeing artists be involved with things outside of our campus. Our campus is a very magical place. I'd love to see the Guild spirit extend to a lot of places. Mm-hmm. And so getting them a chance to be involved with, you know, something bigger than this is great.
Yeah, it was like something you mentioned this morning was wanting to bring some of the artists from down there up here and
yeah.
be able to mm-hmm. go, which I think would be...
Well, we'd all benefit then from the getting to know them a little bit, because the rest of us don't know the
right.
folks in Haiti, so it'd be nice for us to meet some folks and build those relationships more.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It'd be really great. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we're in the process of trying to get those visas mm-hmm. now, so... we will announce that with great joy.
Yes.
Whenever it happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, hopefully that'll come about sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, we'll go ahead and wrap this up. First ever Guild podcast.
Yay.
Like,
yeah, right.
Cheer like go Bundy.
Woo!
yeah, so thanks for listening. If you've made it here to the end. And again, check out parentprojects.org or feel free to email us at the Guild if you have any questions or feedback or input. And thanks so much. I've been Andy and Dan and Scott and Jane, and I hope that you guys will tune in again.
Great. Okay.